Well, hello and welcome to another edition of Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to open up the subject of death and dying and talk around it and about it. And today I'm delighted to be joined by Lucy Pollock, who's a consultant geriatrician, very well known for her two books. She works in Somerset and she's written books called The Book About Getting Older and The Golden Rule. And they're both so appropriate for this podcast, Lucy. Would you like to tell me, first of all, what they're both about?
Thank you so much. And Dillis, thank you so much for inviting me. It really is a treat. And what are the books about? The first one is a sort of curriculum. I'd wanted to write it for years. For about 20 years, I wanted to write this book. And I knew I couldn't when I started out because I actually didn't know enough. I was just stepping into geriatric medicine. And then I wanted to write a book for my patients and their families or people like them. And to explain what the questions are that people should be asking. What should you expect as you get older? What's normal and what's common but not normal? And so what I've done is used loads of stories, which are all based on real life, obviously, patients, to explain the medicine and some of the ethics and the law and what do doctors have to do. And so should my mum be taking 11 different medicines? How do I stop my dad from driving if he's becoming unsafe? How do I know if I've got dementia? What do I do if I've got dementia? All of these questions. And then obviously loss and dying, of course, comes into that as well. So they're kind of, the first book is a kind of handbook, but told through stories. And then the second one, I was rather surprised to write it because actually I wasn't expecting to write a second book. So I was very lucky because the publisher said, oh, come on, where's the next one? And when I started it, I really didn't know what I was going to write. And I thought it was a complete dog's dinner, if I'm honest about it. But in fact, it got really lovely reviews. And I think what I've written is a sort of reflection. And then I've written about what's working, because there is some really good stuff that is working, but also we are not getting this right. So I've written a bit of a manifesto for the future, kind of what do we need to change? How do we approach the next 20 or 30 years of looking after older people? So yes, sort of part, yes. Yeah, that's what that one is.
Perhaps we could talk about that towards the end of this recording, because it would be good to know what you think is okay and what we could change. But
yes,
there are other things I'd like to ask along the way, so can we hold that off for a bit? And I thought the first thing I wanted to know was, what is old age? When does old age start? How do we know we're old? I mean,
we really don't. Honestly, Dillis, I was 60 last year and I've got one of my birthday cards from a friend I've got above my desk at work, and it says, isn't it weird being the same age as old people? And you think, I mean, obviously 60 isn't old, but it, 50 years ago, 60 really was very old. So A, it's a moving target. B, it's completely different from one individual to another. C, does it really matter? I mean, it's important to acknowledge that things change and one's body changes, but also perhaps one's views change and one's hopes and expectations change. And it's really important as a doctor that we actually take account of individuals much more carefully as you get old. You know, if you see a 7-year-old with a broken arm, you're going to fix the broken arm. There isn't really much sort of ethical dilemma about that. But if I meet somebody who's incredibly fragile and maybe has been living with dementia, and there's a question about what kind of treatment is right for them, I really have to individualise my approach. So it's not perhaps so much about somebody's age as about their, what else is going on in their life. So I think that's a pretty, who knows? And importantly, I think we can get the younger, I think people have become very afraid of ageing, much more than they used to be. And there are good questions as to why that is. I think it's really important not to be afraid of it. And that's why people need power and information to dispel some of the myths and fears. And so I haven't answered your question.
Well, I suppose we, as you said, it's an individual thing and we are all different. And I think the worry about getting older is that you assume the medical profession is going to treat you all the same.
Yes. Exactly. And you assume that they're going to know what they're doing and you assume they're going to get it right. And I have to say, we do not get it right a lot of the time. I mean, for example, we now know that about 1 in 7 emergency admissions of older people, that's over the age of 65, to hospital, is due to a problem with their medicines. than medications. That is completely insane. If we said that of surgery, if we said one in five surgical admissions was because of a problem with the previous surgeon, we'd be all over the Daily Mail and quite right too. And yet we've allowed this very complicated system and situation to arise with people with multiple different conditions at once being prescribed lots and lots of different medications. So that's one of the things that we dramatically need to change. And doctors, in order to do that, need to understand the individual. You have to understand what your patient is hoping to achieve from what you're doing. So you have to build it into your processes in medicine. And I'm really proud, for example, we've got some fantastic nurses that work in ED. They're called acute frailty nurses. And they pick out people who they know are likely to be in trouble, perhaps who are confused, fragile, have come in with a fall or the various problems that are very familiar to us. And one of their on their document that they use is what matters to me, what is important to me, and it's right at the front. Now, they don't put that in at the very beginning because they are asking questions about where does it hurt and things like that. But by the time they've assessed the patient and got to know them, that box is populated. And now we know where this person is in life's trajectory. What are they hoping for? What do they want to avoid in the way of treatment? And then we start getting it right. So you can build it in, and we have to. And there's some really good work going on internationally to try and make that happen. But my golly, it's an uphill struggle.
So I suppose we really all ought to be taking responsibility for that ourselves, should we, in thinking ahead and working out what.
Well, this is exactly it. So it is getting the balance between what you expect people to do for themselves or to be responsible for. And that's hard. You haven't got a medical degree or a degree in pharmacology or whatever. So, it's very reasonable to say, well, I don't know what these tablets are for and so on. But it is also very reasonable to say, you need to ask and and you need to take some responsibility for making sure that your wishes are documented. For example, I feel I've quite often meet older people who might maybe have had a friend who's had a really rotten time in later life and perhaps has been treated with things they wouldn't want and perhaps even kept alive in a way they wouldn't want. And my friend Jane would say, oh, I hope the doctors don't keep me alive like that. And I think, well, hope isn't a plan, Jane. You are actually going to have to write that one down somewhere, share it with your family, and make sure that your doctors know that that is your feeling about the situation. So a lot of what my work is about shifting power from doctors to my patients and their families. I think that is key to the future.
So could you give me an idea what an ordinary person like me could do? I mean, I'm imagining you're saying if I've been in a car accident and all my organs have shut down, I don't want to be kept alive. But on the other hand, if there's something minor wrong, I'd like the best to be done as
Like it
possible.
repairing. Yes, and obviously the goals change as you get older. So if you're going to write, there are various structures you can use, Dilys, and it's worth discussing them. So the one that is most in use across the UK is something called a treatment escalation plan. And that comes in various forms. One that's commonly used is called a RESPECT document. It's a purple document that lots of places in the UK use. In Somerset, we use a thing called a treatment escalation plan, and the real joy of ours is it's now online, which is fantastic because when I make it with a patient, the GP can see it immediately. If they change their minds a month later and the GP changes it, that change is immediately captured for me to see. And the ambulance team can see it, and maybe a care home staff, if they've got permission, can see it, and so on. It's really important. So, for anybody who is perhaps in care, if you had a friend or a relative who was living in a care setting or was fragile at home with carers coming in and so on, having one of those is really important. And it's good because it's not just about resus. It captures that decision, but it also says actually those questions like, would you want to come into hospital? But shall we talk about intensive care? How high is the level of treatment going to go? And there are people who are living in a care home who may say, actually, I don't want to go to hospital at all. If I get a horrible pneumonia, you can give me some oral antibiotics. If I can take the tablets, I will. If I'm so unwell I can't swallow a tablet, please don't bundle me into hospital for IV antibiotics and oxygen and the rest of it. I'd rather stay and end my days here. That's fine. And then I've got also very fragile patients who will say, oh, steady on, I want a bit of everything. If you've got a half a chance of keeping me going, please can you throw the book at me? That's fine, and it's important that's documented as well. So a treatment escalation plan is a good idea for anybody who's vulnerable. And then if you they're not legally binding, they give us good information and we should follow them. We have to have a very good reason not to follow the decisions in that. If one wants to take the situation that you sort of described of having been in a horrendous accident and perhaps being unconscious on a ventilator fed by a tube and so on, if that is something that you think, oh, that is not for me, you can make a legally binding decision, an advanced decision to refuse treatment. And it needs to be written down. It needs to, there's a form of words because it's got to say, I understand that this decision will shorten my life. But you can say, I do not want to be kept alive on a ventilator or fed by tube if there's no prospect of recovery. That is legally binding. It needs to be signed and witnessed. And the hitch with that is it's always a bit difficult to know where to put it because it can be written on any old bit of paper and it's no good if it's at the back of a cubby hole in your desk. So if one feels strongly about it, again, it's something to talk to your GP about and get it onto your medical records. But that is slightly oddly informal but legally binding, whereas the other document, the treatment escalation plan, is formal and not legally binding. So, but it's pragmatic. It's a very pragmatic approach.
How would you do the treatment escalation plan? Can we go
You
online and find one or?
need to discuss it with usually the GP. Sometimes, if it's for somebody in a care home, sometimes the matron of the care home may have been given permission to create a treatment escalation plan. Often, very good advanced clinical practitioners, that's nurses or physios with extra training, are very good at creating those documents. And often they're created in hospital. To be honest, most of them are created on the hoof in the emergency department in the very situation they were designed to avoid. So it's a good question, how would I get one? And the answer is ask for it and say, I would like, especially if you're speaking on behalf of yourself or a friend, to say, I think we should be making a treatment escalation plan. Can we discuss that?
It's quite a lot to think about as you get older because you've got to think about your wills and your letter of wishes and all these things, and now your treatment escalation plan. So we need to know about all this stuff, don't we?
Yeah, there's a lot of business to do with getting older, isn't it?
Yeah.
But the one thing about it is you can, I love the phrase plan it and park it. So, do the decision, have the conversation, which may get quite tearful with your family about what your wishes are. These are important, big emotional decisions. And then get it all documented, go and have fish and chips by the sea. You've done the work. Don't worry about it anymore.
I was thinking about Shakespeare this morning and thinking that you've made so many medical advances, you medical people, that we now don't get to the stage where we're sans teeth and sans eyes because we have our cataracts done and we have our teeth looked after. So presumably that presents a problem for you medics, doesn't it? Because we're all living longer, healthier.
Oh, living longer and healthier is the dream. And that's really important that living longer doesn't necessarily present problems in terms of the cost of healthcare and so on. So there's all this terrible drama out there about, the silver tsunami and very ageist conversations about the cost of healthcare. But the key thing is if we can get people to do what most of us want to do, which is be alive and well, alive and well, alive and well dead. And a lot of people do manage that. And we know very famous, well-known people who live into their 90s, fit well, independent, look at the Queen, how fantastic. Give somebody a knighthood, one short illness, and a peaceful death in your own home. My golly, that's what we're aiming for, all of us, is what we would like to achieve. And to be honest, the Queen's a good illustration because that sadly is very socioeconomically defined as well. So well-off older people are much more likely to have that trajectory of their life. But lots of other people run into trouble earlier on, and these are often to do with poverty and difficulty in childhood and poor education, which then builds up over time into all the sort of lifestyle things that make things difficult for people. So, high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, smoking, and so on. And what those do is really hit you in later life by making your quality of life deteriorate with a heart attack or a stroke or dementia and so on. So the questions, there's a great big public health question about how do we address that? How do we help people stay fit and well later in life? And then there's this question of what do you do if you are in that situation with those problems of frailty, which can happen to anybody. I mean, part of it is luck as well, obviously, Dilys. You can lead an incredibly blameless life and eat nothing but lettuce leaves and never touch salt and the rest of it and still run into trouble. So, luck plays its part, which is why all of us need to have the conversation about what our hopes and expectations are.
And how much does attitude play a part? Because there are some people who are born positive, aren't there? And there are other people who seem to be born negative. And does one outlive the other? I
Yes,
assume.
I think we've kind of known that in our bones as human beings for a very long time. But actually, there's now some really cracking science behind it, which I love. So, science from Ireland, an amazing woman called Roseanne Kenny, who runs a big aging research program in Ireland, they looked at people's attitude to aging and divided people broadly into a group of people who agree with statements like, as I get older, I get wiser, I'm still curious, I have experience, and so on. And then there's a separate group of people who tend to agree with statements like, I feel washed up, I feel left out, my life is effectively over. And those two groups age physically completely differently. So having the positive attitude gives you about 7.5 years extra life, and most of that time will be, physically better. And in a way, that completely makes sense because it means that if you are one of those slightly more positive people, your friend invites you to go to the cinema or you're trying to decide whether to go on holiday, and you think, yes, I will do it. Yes, let's do that. If you're on the negative side, you might think, oh, there's nowhere to park and not do it. And immediately you can see that you are reducing your social contacts and your physical activity. So it makes perfect sense. But the other thing that's fascinating, this is a piece of research from the US. Becca Levy, a very famous Yale psychologist, and one of her early studies looked at, again, this time a big group of older people, and she randomized them into two groups. And she then showed them each some words on a screen. And the first group, she showed those lovely positive words about resilience and wisdom and sagacity. And the second group, she showed words like frailty, vulnerability, decrepitude, dementia, etc., all negative words. And then they all did the same test of cognition, of brain power. And guess what? The people with the positive words did better on the test of cognition. But the kicker is, they didn't know what they'd seen. And this sends shivers down my spine every time I think about this trial. The words were flashed up so fast that you couldn't actually register them, but your brain was getting the message. So the way we talk about aging affects our cognition. So nationally, if we keep talking negatively about older people, we are doing our nation's IQ a disservice, which is nuts. So it's about getting this balance of being positive, optimistic, but also being realistic.
Every older person is portrayed as somebody frail. They've always got a walking stick. They're always bent over. Their hands are always wrinkly. How on earth do we overcome that?
Okay, so there are really good campaigns against that, and the old wrinkly hands illustration in a news article. I always ask if I'm interviewed, I say, please, if you've got photographs, please don't put the wrinkly hands in there. Let's have some realistic pictures of what older people actually are doing. So, most older people, even in their 90s, live independently at home. The minority are in a care home. One in three people in their 90s will get dementia. Two out of three of them don't, and they're flipping sharp as a tack. A great old family friend of ours who's just turned 90 has just launched his podcast in which he interviews other nonagenarians. So if you're, it's Johnny Tooser. He was a wonderful BBC journalist and had a long career in the arts. What a fantastic thing to do. So let's change that narrative. I have a feeling the boomer generation may take control of this situation because they're not that keen on the old wrinkly hands images, and they are doing impressive things in civic life. And I think we will change that narrative, but we do need to be careful because it is a danger, it can creep in very easily. Do you know geriatric medicine is now the biggest single specialty in the UK? Hooray for that!
That's amazing. How did that happen?
Good question. I think that what has happened is over the years, geriatricians have proved their worth. And finally, people are beginning to realize that it's not just about patting somebody's hand and saying they're there. This is a proper scientific specialty with a really good evidence base, masses of science and research behind it. And it's flipping complicated. Some of the brainiest people go into geriatric medicine, especially I love watching our young doctors now. I can spot them. And I think you're going to be a geriatrician because you are able and you're interested and you're humane and you're going to enjoy this career as well. And it's not all about spending money. If you do geriatric medicine well, if you do medicine well, you save loads and loads of money. This isn't about prolonging lives in a state of misery. This is about adding, as they say, adding life to years, not years to life. And focusing on independence, on quality of life, on what people like doing, on what matters to them. Can we help you so that you can go on attending your history society meetings? All of this stuff that, I don't know, 30 years ago, the pioneers of geriatric medicine knew about it, but the rest of the world didn't. And I think people now do.
When we last spoke, I asked you, how do we age well? And you gave me five pointers. Would you like to give those now, if you can remember
Yes,
them?
it's so, and it's people want the magic pill, don't they? And they
Yeah.
want, even in the newspaper yesterday, I read about seven supplements you should take to defer aging, beetroot juice and God knows what. You just think, oh, there is absolutely no science about that. So let's do the really boring things are don't smoke, drink in moderation, eat a sensible diet, which is basically eat food rather than ultra processed food, eat less of it, mostly plants, fantastic. We're getting the message on that. Maintain some social connections and interests, that is important. And then finally, the key one is move. So for lots of my patients, the key movement is not being able to run a marathon or do tons of weights, although that's not a bad idea. But the movement that counts is this one. Stand up from chair. And all of us as a nation, we are so increasingly sedentary. So that key thing of moving, there are some others increasingly. I mean, for example, hearing, we know that that contributes substantially to people's cognitive decline because you're just not getting the intellectual stimulation. You're not hearing the conversation. So lots of that is remediable. So I would say watch out for that eyesight, just making sure that you can still read the paper. So, but the big five are those smoking, eating, drinking in moderation, being active physically and mentally.
We all need to be thinking about that in our late 50s, would you say?
I think the age that yes, those trigger birthdays are a bit of a motivator, aren't they? And they come round and you think, oh golly, I think I probably ought to do something about this. So certainly the exercise and maintaining muscle strength, that would be something where it might be a good idea to start intervening in your 50s if you haven't before. I mean, any age is a good age to start exercising. And the really key thing is there is no age too old to start taking exercise. And I love watching people in their 80s and 90s improve their muscle strength. And they've often lost it because of something sad, like a hip fracture or something. They've been in bed for a while, their muscles have melted away, they've got spaghetti legs. But my golly, you watch them do a good exercise program and you watch that strength. And I've done it to myself. I started doing weights when I turned 60, actually, trigger birthday. And I can lift a lot heavier weight now than I could 6 months ago. And I love it. I'm a different shape and I feel better.
And modern society isn't really geared up for us moving a lot, is it? And the reason I raise that is because I went to talk to one of my grandson's primary schools the other day about the old days, the olden days. And I described how we used to have to get up to turn the television on. And then we used to have to get up to change the channel. And then we had to get up to turn it off. And if you think about it, we also used to have to walk to the post office, didn't we, if we wanted to communicate with anybody. And we had to do our own washing up. And we had to, all these things have changed to our detriment. In a way.
It really has. I mean, be careful what you wish for. All of these little
Yes.
lovely technologies actually mean we're on our feet a lot less of the day. And obviously that there are bonuses for that in terms of, really hard labouring jobs that have largely gone away and that really didn't do people very much good. working very hard manual labor for year after year after year was probably not a good idea. But yes, the domestic things that affect most of us mean that we are on our bottoms a lot of the time, and we need to get off them and start moving and just walking to school. That children now do not walk to school, and there is a movement obviously to try and start that up again, but it's quite tricky to get humans to move. We like sitting still.
Lucy, this has been fascinating, but let's go back to where we started when you said there are things we get wrong and there are things we do wonderfully well. Could you just sum those two up?
Okay, so why don't we start with the good stuff first? So what do we do well? Increasingly, we have a very well-trained workforce in the NHS. So I think going back to that geriatric medicine thing, it's not just all about doctors. There are nurses, physios, OTs, social workers, and so on, with a huge, much, much more knowledge of the aging process and the challenges. So we've got better from that point of view. The l lovely campaign, Hello, My Name Is, we are getting better at introducing ourselves to our patients. And I watch that among our young doctors. That is absolutely key. We still forget to say, what would you like to be called? And it drives me nuts when older people in hospital are called by a name that they haven't been called since they were a baby, but it's the one on their notes. Just ask people what they would like to be called. So we are getting better at that. We are getting better at understanding the complexities of aging, and we have got incredibly much better treatments for a lot of conditions, including cancer, that 10 or 15 years ago, the treatment would have been too difficult for my patient to have. And now, the chemo would have been the end of them. And now, instead of saying, I don't think you need to see an oncologist because actually this has gone too far, I have, and we're going to do supportive care, I actually have to think very carefully before that, because there may well be a new treatment that is not as harrowing as the old ones and is very effective. So there is a very rapidly changing landscape of good, worthwhile treatments that older people should not be excluded from just because they're old. We need to think about the whole person. So that's happening. We are also doing what West Streeting wants us to do, and my golly, we need to accelerate it. Get the care out of hospital and back into the community. Lots of older people do much, much better if they're treated in their own homes. That can be their nursing home, care home, or their own nice home where they live. And so things like building up hospital at home, the technology. I love that our hospital at home team can do a blood test in somebody's bedroom. I was working with them. I take blood next to the patient in a care home, and I have the blood result there from a little machine next to me in 10 minutes' time. Tremendous. And we can now increasingly do ultrasound and things like that in people's own homes. So that's fantastic. That is really good stuff. Recognizing the social prescribing element and really investing in companionship and community, that has finally, the pennies drop that that is a worthwhile investment, and that we need to push that forward. So those are good things. What are we doing wrong? I've spoken about medication. So what can people do to help themselves in that situation? Ask. Say, hang on a minute, why am I taking all this medicine? So what I would like to know, I do a little framework called BRAN, which is from a fantastic international campaign called Choosing Wisely. BRAN is very good for us in lots of ways, but one of them is that it stands for, what are the benefits? What are the risks? What are the alternatives? What happens if I do nothing? And we can ask those questions about any medication we're taking. What is this for? How good is it? How much? Okay, it's aspirin to prevent a stroke or to prevent a heart attack. Is it going to prevent a heart attack, or is it just going to marginally reduce the risk by a very small amount at the same time as having some side effects? Let's have the conversation. What are the risks? What are the alternatives? And what happens if I don't change anything at all? So those are a good question. You're going to ask them about operations and blood tests and scans and all sorts of things before going in. What else are we doing badly? Social care is a complete calamity, and our failure to work out a good mechanism for financing social care is really awful and is costing us an enormous amount of money, because apart from anything else, it's making the NHS grind. We are really hampered by the fact that we don't have good systems for funding equitable social care. we are not being careful enough about building up secure communities for older people to live in. You know, we need to look at the international examples like the Netherlands, and instead of gazing at it in admiration, actually let's do some of that. Those are the big ones, together with the sort of nation's public health issues of obesity and inactivity. Those are the things that we are getting wrong. But they've all got solutions, Dilys. They're not, you know, they're not, we can't just roll our eyes and say it's all going to hell in a handcart. There are techniques for making this situation better.
Lucy, I have one more question. What's your plan?
Good question. You know, a lovely German journalist said, "What age do you want to die at?" I thought, jeepers, I have no idea. But I kind of do know what I'd like to be doing quite soon before I die. I was thinking about her question. I would like to have the dog's lead in my hand. I would like to have the taste of a glass of cold white wine. I would like, or an olive. I would love to have the kiss of a grandchild. You know, we haven't got grandchildren yet, but maybe we will have, or of somebody that I love. So I think I do have an advanced decision to refuse treatment. I have done that, and my husband and I have sorted out lasting power of attorney as well, and our children are pretty clear about what our wishes would be in various situations. So there is the framework is there. And then after that, my plan is enjoy every minute. Life is really precious and fantastic, and I want to say how lucky I am and also make the most of the time that I've got.
Inspirational. Thank you, Lucy, so much for sharing all that with us. Great pleasure to meet you. Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.